From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Oxford-educated classicist Dr. Spencer Clavin, author of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Spencer Clavin in their conversation.
The notion that everything is just matter, it's just physical, it's just stuff, that notion comes along with a conviction that everything behaves according to predictable rules. And what these guys never answer, Stephen Hawking made exactly the same argument in the Wall Street Journal, and these guys never answer the question, where do the rules come from, right? Rules are not physical. Rules are not stuff. They are operations of the mind, right? But that is kind of left off the table or just ignored, shrugged away. And what you end up with is just a machine, right? Just this thing that spits out certain consequences and results. And usually this is presented in this kind of faux inspirational way. You get Carl Sagan, right? We are star stuff, right? Meaning we're just made of the atoms that stars cough up, right? And Sarah Silverman, the comedian, says something similar when she won, I think, her Emmy. She said, like, you know, we're just atoms and we're hurtling through the universe. And isn't that great? Doesn't that set us free? Isn't that liberating? You go online, you read what regular people say, you get a very different story. I've seen Reddit posts where people say things like, I'm just atoms. Why does anything matter? Right? That's the crisis of meaning. Because of course, if it is just there, if it's just doing mindlessly what the universe has always done from infinity and will go on doing into infinity, then actually there's no reason to live at all. There's no meaning to anything that you do because there's no ultimate object of your mimesis, of your representation. And I think we are really up against that crisis, not just in its kind of failure to explain the universe and the necessity of inventing all these things like, you know, multiple universes to account for the otherwise obvious hints of design that we see, but also in its failure to inspire. Our attempts, our art gets worse and worse the more we dig into this. And the example I give in the book is the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the MCU, which has now become a multiverse because that's the latest, right, in kind of purely mechanistic, godless physics. And those stories, why do they get worse and worse? Why are they such schlock? Well, it's because when somebody dies, right, it doesn't actually have any consequence. It's just a bunch of atoms kind of dissipating. Maybe they'll come back together in another universe or at another time. The only thing that really is driving those plots at this point is the financial convenience of the studios and the actors and the executives. And the more this stuff breaks down and the more they, you know, dig in their heels about, oh, the science is settled and trust the experts, right? Trust the science. The more you see that really you're up against two competing religions, the religion of meaning and the religion of what I call scientism. That's the crisis. That's the choice that we face.
Yeah, so well said. We've touched on the crisis of reality, the crisis of the body, the crisis of meaning. I want to get into the fourth crisis, the crisis of religion. What is that crisis to your understanding?
Yeah. Well, it follows directly on from what we've been discussing with regards to science. There was a moment in the history of the West, which is typically kind of referred to as the scientific revolution. And no moment, I think, is more misunderstood in our relatively recent history than this moment, this sort of 300 to 400 year period, where not only did Protestantism become a major force, and not only did the, you know, Catholic Church lose some of its grip over the political world in Europe during the 30 Years' War and so forth, but also, of course, this is what came to be known as sort of this new enlightenment, this new idea about the world that it could be known through reason as a kind of machine comes into being. And in order to do that, which has, you know, in some ways, there were many things that came out of science, the scientific revolution, that were very wonderful, all sorts of medicines, technologies, right? We live longer. Nobody would want to undo any of that. The process, though, of achieving this sort of revolution was to treat the world as if without reference to God. And as I say in the book, that's very, very different from saying that God does not exist. And in fact, when Isaac Newton was challenged, asked, you know, what is it that exerts this force of gravity that acts at a distance. He said, hypotheses non fingo. I'm not going to make up hypotheses where my science isn't invited, isn't trying to answer those questions. And in some sense, as the philosophy of science has developed in the 20th century and with people like Karl Popper, you've had this narrowing, this real precision about what does science do? Well, it finds the questions that you can pose and answer in these experimental ways. And that is a noble and longstanding practice with roots way back into the natural philosophy of Aristotle and indeed even before. What simultaneously happened is that sophists, pop philosophers, represented this triumph as a triumph over God, as if by excluding God from the question, what we had done was disprove his existence. Because if we can account for everything that matters, well, then we don't need God to explain anything. And you see, it's very so subtle what happens there, because of course, you can account for everything that matters if you define everything that matters as physical. You can answer every question if you never ask any of the questions to which God is the only possible answer. You never say, well, you know, what is the purpose of human life? What is the meaning in the universe? Why do I feel things? Why do I have qualitative experiences and a soul rather than just a body, right? And so now you end up in this position where, sort of absurdly, people think that religion has been disproven or outdated. And yet, at the same time, all around us, the very stones cry out of our need for religion. Because what we've really done, rather than giving up or abandoning our religion, people say the West is secularizing. It's not quite true. What's actually happened is that these practices like science and these social justice movements have begun to take on the character of a religion. We turn to them for the meaning of our lives, for questions about right and wrong. We kneel at Black Lives Matter rallies. We sort of perform these ritual acts of absolution and forgiveness. Because mankind is more than physical, human beings need answers to questions that physical science can't answer. And so when you cut that route off, when you cut the vertical element out of human life, then you force people into this absurd position of using whatever they can get their hands on as if it were a religion. And this is why you get these kind of awestruck descriptions of evolution, primordial slime gradually developing into the human mind. And isn't it beautiful that this mindless universe coughed up a human being? These stories that we tell that don't fit with what's actually being said at all, that are pure wishmaking, because what we are so desperate for is a philosophy, is a way of understanding the world that doesn't just reduce us to mindless atoms bouncing through a void. And of course, what I argue in the book is, you know, sometimes Christians, we try to proselytize right into like every possible doctrine all at once. You get the Nicene Creed, you know, in all of its points immediately. But the advice that I have for evangelists in this book, if any, is that, you know, the people you're dealing with, the people in the Western world right now, are crying out, struggling with much more basic questions. They're in need of much more basic food. We have to take our baby steps again and recognize that none of these crises, the crisis of the body, the crisis of reality, the crisis of meaning, none of these crises is going to be meaningful or satisfactorily answered until we admit that there is something beyond the material world, something more than flesh, something that is spiritual. And that's the crisis of religion. And there's only one way out.
You've already touched on this, but I want you to expand at least briefly on your contention that the Enlightenment did a disservice to Western civilization, a disservice because the scientism becomes popular, the religion is denigrated as barbarous, and it is repositioned as a hazard as opposed to the solution.
Well, one thing I think, and I say this in the book, one thing that we typically don't understand about the period that's called the Enlightenment, right, this sort of, you know, 18th century flowering of the humanistic arts, is that it's really coming in the wake of all those developments I just described earlier, which are to say that the Protestant Reformation, the 30 Years' War, which undermined, called into question the authority of the Catholic Church, for good or ill. I'm making absolutely no claim here about the positive or negative value of, you know, the Catholic authority that was exerted in Europe before this moment. But just as a matter of fact, when you, as Europe did, when you say that each nation, each prince is now going to be free, essentially, to govern according to his own sect or kind of Christianity, you suddenly throw open this question about where authority rests, where do we look for truth? And I think there was a lot that was salutary about asking that question. We should be bold to ask any question, seek any truth that needs finding. But what you get then in sort of in the wake of that is this caricature of religion as the purely oppressive force that held back all of this creative energy that we're now releasing in the glorious scientific revolution, but also in the glorious French Revolution. And, you know, even as these revolutions devolve often into bloodshed or anarchy or uncertainty, chaos, you still have this conviction, which, you know, again, I would never attribute to every Enlightenment philosophe. I would never say that, you know, everybody was involved in this grand conspiracy at this moment. But what you did have were people like Julien Offray de Lamettrie, you had Diderot, you had indeed Voltaire famously saying, écraser l'infâme, get rid of the disgusting infamy, which is the church, right? And not even necessarily at that point was it yet get rid of God, although it was in some cases, but it was just get rid of these hierarchies, these institutions. And you see in that moment the beginning of a gesture that we now make all the time, which is, you know, this institution, this part of our culture is run by flawed individuals.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with scholar Spencer Klavan. In his new book, How to Save the West, Oxford-educated classicist Spencer Klavan writes for people who want to save the West but don't know how. The fate of our civilization depends on whether ordinary people internalize the truth and beauty conveyed in the masterpieces of Western culture. Dr. Klavan defends that culture and explains why and how we must hand it on to the next generation. Be sure to read How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. To receive your copy, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Endless predictions about end-time events and published timetables counting down the end have proven to be wrong 100% of the time. When doomsday predictions fail, there is double-duty damage. Many theologically juvenile and scripturally superficial Christians abandon the faith as a result of these failed predictions, and the public image of Christianity is damaged, making Christians appear to be hopelessly naive and easily duped biblical bumpkins. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will equip you not only to interpret biblical prophecy correctly, but to remember it as well. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org. In his new book, How to Save the West, Spencer Clavin writes, Western civilization is not some ethnic or tribal marker designed to keep undesirables out. Just the opposite. It is a set of ideas and masterpieces shared among people from an enormous range of races and times. Nor is Western thought a kind of dogma, a set of points to which all Westerners must ascribe. In this book, says Dr. Clavin, we will discuss philosophers like Karl Marx and David Hume, who I believe represent wrong turns and dead ends in the Western journey. But they are Westerners too, and I criticize them because I think our shared heritage points in another, better direction. To receive your copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, classicist Spencer Clavin, in their conversation.
You had Voltaire famously saying, écrasez l'infâme, get rid of the disgusting infamy, which is the church, right? And not even necessarily at that point was it yet get rid of God, although it was in some cases, but it was just get rid of these hierarchies, these institutions. And you see in that moment the beginning of a gesture that we now make all the time, which is, you know, this institution, this part of our culture is run by flawed individuals. Christopher Columbus did bad things. Some of the founding fathers kept slaves, right? And so they fell short, indeed, of all these grand ideals. And therefore, we must condemn them because we know so much more than they do. What that always misses out, what you always lose when you act and think that way, is you miss the fact that the reason the founding fathers fall short in your estimation is because of values that the founding fathers instilled in you through the documents that they left behind. It's true everywhere, at all times and places, that human beings fall short of their ideals. But the only way that we even know that they fall short is because of those ideals in the first place. And so when you say, for instance, of the church, well, this was, you know, the church was not as open to, say, the heliocentric universe, to the idea that the earth revolves around the sun. The church wasn't as open to that as it ought to have been. You think, well, where do you get the idea of openness in the first place, right? Where do you have this notion that truth, right, needs seeking? Well, of course, this comes in large part out of the church itself. It's because of the long centuries of the academic tradition that the scientific revolution in some ways reacts against, right? It's because of this huge structure of Western thought that we even, you know, began to do what became the scientific revolution in the first place. And so we have this constant, I call it chronological chauvinism in the book, this constant knee-jerk reaction now that if the development of something doesn't live up to our standards, then what we ought to do is get rid of it altogether. And what we realize then all too late is that the standards came from the thing we just throw out to begin with. And so it's the very definition of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Talk about the scientific infatuation with multiverse. That's something you touch on in the book, and I think it's worth elaborating. I run into it all the time. It seems to be the explanation. You can infinitely regress with this explanation. You never come to a solution, but there's a fascination with this hypothesis.
It's such a fad. It's very, very popular, and popular even among people who, if you show them its consequences, will suddenly think, oh, maybe I don't really want to believe in that as much as I thought. In essence, as I argue in the book, when you come up against multiverse theories and the popularity of multiverse theories, what you're dealing with is the gradual accumulation of, I won't say evidence, because it's not, you know, you never get a final proof of these matters, but more and more indications, hints, that the creative impulse of a mind is the best explanation for many of the phenomena we see in our universe, in the universe we occupy. Fine-tuning is a good example of this phenomenon, which sort of throughout the late 20th century, these kind of observations that all sorts of mathematical constants operate in the physical universe just within the narrow band of values that they need to have in order for conscious life to come into being. The configuration of mass and energy at the beginning of the universe was just so balanced that human life could eventually exist within this universe. And this concept, which indicates at least that one good explanation would be, as the astrophysicist Fred Hoyle put it, a super intellect that monkeys with the universe. The sort of shadow of God is looming in these data, unless you're devoted to preserving the materialist universe, which again is not a finding of science. No experiment ever proved that the world is made up only of matter and there's nothing supernatural in it. It's a premise, a presupposition of many scientific endeavors. And so in order to preserve that premise, you have to think of some other explanation for all these phenomena that we see in the world. And the multiverse is one way of doing that, of accounting for our universe and the way it looks without invoking God. If our universe is just one among a potentially infinite number of universes, well, then it's just like the monkeys at the typewriter, right? They're clacking away and eventually they cough up the text of Hamlet, because given enough time and enough variations, you're bound to produce what you might call a bubble universe where life exists. And so there's kind of two versions of this in point of fact. One of them is a proposition that was sort of floated by Erwin Schrödinger of the famous Schrödinger's cat thought experiment, and then really fleshed out by this guy, Hugh Everett, the notion that because quantum physics operates with equations that have kind of indeterminacy built into them, multiple possibilities before an observer is introduced into the picture, well, then maybe we can imagine that all of those possibilities are always obtaining, right? They're always happening in some universe or another. So Schrödinger's cat isn't dead and alive before we observe it. It's not dead or alive. It's dead in our universe and alive in some other universe, or it's alive in this universe and it's dead in another. The other version of this is string cosmology has this kind of notion of an expanding universe that's constructed out of minutely vibrating strings that then break down and sort of reconstitute themselves in different pockets. You'll notice that nothing I've said has quite fixed the problem, because if you just propose that there's this big universe generating machine, well, who built the machine, right? Like, you're just sort of kicking the can down the road. But even leaving that problem aside, there's all sorts of issues with both of these ideas. The bubble universe theory is founded on all sorts of things that we have never observed and can never observe. And some advocates of it are even proposing that we should give the scientific imprimatur even to things that aren't provable by experiment, just to preserve this notion of the multiverse. But a bigger problem from the perspective of somebody like me is, well, once you're operating in terms of hypotheses, just imaginary sort of speculative ideas about what we would call cosmology, then you don't actually get to argue as if you have some scientific finding. What you're really doing is you're doing religion. You're doing theology, you're doing cosmology. Or,
under the guise of science. Yeah.
Exactly, with the imprimatur, as if nobody can argue with you. But in fact, we very much can argue over these sorts of things and have been doing since the beginning, when Epicurus proposed that there were multiple universes, and all the same problems still maintain, right? Like, what does it even mean to have an identity or to make an observation in a multiverse when everything is happening somewhere at some point, right? That movie is called Everything Everywhere All at Once. If you watch that movie, it's about the fact that that whole notion is just nihilism. It just explodes the possibility of any action, any love, any connection. All these things break down because the whole idea is kind of a canard.
I want you to elaborate on a statement that you make in the book before we get into the fifth crisis. You say, and I'm quoting you directly here, you say, "I'm suggesting that you already act as if you believe in the world described by Scripture and not the world described by the multiverse and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In your heart of hearts, you don't believe in meaninglessness. You don't really accept the idea that the physical facts fix all the facts. People intuitively know that there's more than physical facts." And you say we should just remind people of what they already perceive and believe. I think that's a brilliant insight. You're simply reminding people of what they have already intuited.
That's right. That's right. I think at some point I say it's less a conversion than a surrender. It's allowing yourself to believe things that you operate as if you believe in every day, but you've been kind of talked out of by the fashions of the day. People who read footnotes, if you like reading footnotes and you search through the footnotes of my book, you will find a little story about one of the disciples of a Greek philosopher named Heraclitus. Now, Heraclitus was the real deal relativist. He went whole hog. He believed that all was in flux, and indeed that every perception is a perception of something different at each moment. And one of his disciples ended up, we're told, saying nothing at all, because every statement would be false the moment it was uttered, and because everything was constantly in this flow of atoms. And so all he did was move his finger. He just sat and moved his finger around. That is a relativist with the courage of his convictions. That is somebody who is living his life, sitting alone and moving his finger because nothing else matters or makes any sense. That is a relativist who is actually living his life according to the implications of his belief. Other people who live their lives as if God does not exist include the Marquis de Sade, right? I mean, these are people who actually operate as if there is no morality, there's no absolute truth. You who are listening to us have this conversation, you out there in the world, don't live that way and really can't. Because in fact, as you say, in your heart of hearts, you know it's not right.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with scholar Spencer Klavan. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises by Dr. Spencer Klavan. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. With the new atheists increasing their mockery of Christianity and militant secularism ridiculing religious convictions of all stripes, we clearly don't need zealous but misguided Christians inviting further abuse by misreading and misrepresenting biblical prophecies. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will enable you to understand, remember, and communicate biblical prophecy. Moreover, your investment in Prophetic Stars through the Christian Research Institute will equip and encourage eager Christian brothers and sisters who genuinely yearn for truth and reliable tools to apprehend and defend their faith. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.